call the Senate Transportation Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is May 3rd and 1:05 p.m. On today's agenda, we have, I believe, seven bills, starting out with Senate File 430. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Today before us, I have Senate File 430, which deals with disability parking provisions, and I do have a delete everything amendment to offer.
Okay. Senator Brown, I understand that that is being prepared as we speak, and copies should be here shortly.
All right.
Do you have a copy of the amendment?
I do.
If you'd go ahead and explain the bill and the amendment, we can probably move forward as soon as we have the amendment available.
Okay. Mr. Chair, it is making some changes to how we deal with certificates for handicapped in vehicles. First change. Right now, statute says that the certificate or placard must be displayed on the dashboard on the driver's side of the vehicle. We would eliminate on the driver's side and allow it to be displayed anywhere on the dashboard. And then Section 2 of the law, turn to that. Deals more with some of the abuse on certificates that have expired or are invalid and how they are dealt with in the court of law or when they must be surrendered, and also places some limitations on the original certificate holder if it were to be abused or misused by a family member or someone else. And I do have testifiers here today, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Senator Brown, if you'd like to start out with the testimony.
Mr. Chair, Pierre Ouellette with the City of Minneapolis. I'll go first.
Mr. Ouellette.
Thank you for the opportunity for letting us speak to you on this bill, and thank you for Senator Brown for helping to authorize this. We came to this issue because of some requests from the our local disability community to do a little heavier enforcement, particularly around expired disability placards. There was a problem with them. We initiated a stronger enforcement program and wrote a lot of tags. Unfortunately, what we found was that a lot of the expired tabs, which we were writing tickets for, were being dismissed at a court level. And upon investigation, we found that there was a certain statute that allowed for a handicap placard to be dismissed, an expired handicap placard to be dismissed regardless of how old it was, if the original certificate holder showed up and said that they still had a valid certificate. This led to a lot of abuse. We believe that there are folks that had disability placards stolen. There are some situations where people who rightfully had a certificate might lend an expired one to a son or a relative or somebody else. And when a ticket was written, the person using that placard would go back to the original certificate holder and ask them to have the ticket dismissed. So it basically led to some, basically we would think abuse, and it made our enforcement efforts, it didn't really help with our enforcement efforts. The bill really does four things for us. Only a disability permit now under this change that's 90 days or less can be dismissed by original permit holder. And then all tickets that are issued for any permit that is reported lost or stolen, regardless of expiration date, tickets can be issued right away. It allows for a process of surrendering tickets that are expired, so that if you come in to dismiss a ticket on an expired ticket, you have to dismiss the expired disability placard. And it clarifies that only the person who's holding the certificate can have it dismissed if it's less than 90 days old. We're supported in this by the League of Minnesota Cities and the City of St. Paul. And I have with me today Clara Schmidt-Gonzalez, who heads up our parking enforcement area, and Assistant City Attorney Heidi Johnston, who works with these type of violations. They don't plan to speak today, but if there are more questions, they'll certainly be able to help. Also with us today is Giogo Reese, and he would like to speak on behalf of the Minnesota State Council on Persons with Disabilities.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Reese.
Thank you, Chairman. Thanks to the committee for hearing the bill today. My name is Giogo Hayes. I'm with the Minnesota State Council on Disability. I just want to speak very briefly in support of the bill. The Council on Disability has some statutory responsibilities regarding disability placards, so I just wanted to take a quick opportunity to say that we do support this bill. We generally work pretty hard to ensure adequate, accessible parking for people, regardless of where they are in the state of Minnesota, and this bill goes a long way in making sure we think that those types of parking isn't being abused by people who shouldn't be using it, so that it's there for people that really do truly need to use it. And I'd be happy to answer any questions, too.
Okay. Just for the record, we do have a quorum, and Senator DeCryf moves the A11-04-04, delete everything amendment to Senate File 430. We have it in proper form before the committee. And Senator Howe, did you have a question?
I just had a question on the I guess I'll need a minute to read this new language because the question I had on the original bill has been changed on the new language, so I'll give me a minute. Thanks.
Okay. Yeah. You're ready.
Mr. Chair, our next testifier does have something to pass around to members if someone could collect those.
We'll have a page come and get that and pass it around. It's just one item that you have. It's not something for all of the members, Senator Brown?
They'll be passed around. If there's any member that has a handicap placard, they, I'm sure, would be welcome to keep it at the end.
Not the one that has my wife's.
No.
That might be under your bill just a little bit illegal to be doing that. So, yeah. Well, welcome to the committee, and look forward to your testimony on the items that you are passing around.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Al Cranky from Rogers. My son and I have a small inventing company. My wife and my daughter-in-law both have MS and the Disabled Persons Certificates. On a windy day, my wife's tag flew out the window. As I retrieved it from under a car, I thought, Patty could not do this. I called Tom and said, I got an idea for another invention. Problems we tried to solve. What do you do with a certificate when it's not hanging from the mirror? Second, today's mirrors are an electronic center, and the placard hook does not always fit over the wires. Third, display the certificate close to the mirror. Fourth, make it inexpensive and easy to use. We designed a holder, received a patent, and we built a mold. We contacted all of the states and provinces. Most were receptive, especially New York, plus California, which will replace free up to 6 certificates per year. Florida legislature and DMV officials are investigating if they can sell our holder and make their disabled program self-supporting. Certificates have to be free, holders do not. We were shocked when Minnesota DOT notified us, you are not in compliance because the holder is not on the driver's side of the dash. This provision was added with good intentions, but in practice, it is the worst possible location. The certificate creates a reflection on the windshield directly in front of the driver. Also from this location, they fly across the dash, out the door, out the window, on the floor, under the seat, and they get lost. This is one reason why people drive with them hanging illegally from their mirror. A holder can save the state money by reducing certificate replacements while providing one less frustration for people that have an extremely frustrating life. When parked, they tip up and can be easily seen by police and citizens from the front or rear. While driving, they lay securely on the dash and provide an unobstructed view. I contacted Senator Round because our certificate holders are made in Becker and assembled and shipped from Options Incorporated, a disabled persons company in Big Lake. I support this entire bill and ask you to remove on the driver's side from Minnesota law. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Cranky. Any questions from the committee? Senator Howe?
No. The new language addresses my concern.
Care of your concerns? Okay. Senator Howell moves that Senate File 430 be recommended to pass as amended and be sent to the Senate floor. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Senator Jungbauer here. Senate File 1058. Senator Jungbauer, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Great to be back to visit my old friends at the Transportation Committee. Members, Senate File 1058 is a simple bill, though if you read through it, it looks kind of lengthy. But what happened, members, and I passed the bill a few years ago, and it's been hard for Department of Vehicle Services to go through and implement everything. They've done some changeovers in their system and things, and so we've extended it out a couple times. But in simple terms, what this does, members, is I've had a few of my constituents get stopped for violations under commercial plate rules. And they had a Y plate on their pickup trucks or their other vehicles. And the Y plate was originally designed to signify a commercial vehicle, and yet other people were able to buy this Y plate. They do sell for less expensive up front than our standard regular plates. So people that had oversized vehicles or heavy gross vehicle weight vehicles were buying the Y plates because I believe at the time they were $135 as opposed to about $400 for license plates if you weren't running a business. So there was nothing in law that actually codified how the plates were to be used. So really what Senate File 1058 does is brings that forward that in the future, if you have a Y plate, it signifies to law enforcement, to commercial vehicle people, that vehicle is operated as a commercial vehicle for a business purpose and not for a private purpose. And that's simply what it is, though it's lengthy. It has to deal with a lot of other things. So I guess that's as simple as it is, members, if you have some questions. I have people here that can testify, Pat McCormick, or others, to let you know what the other specifics are if that isn't clear enough.
Certainly. Welcome to the committee, Ms. McCormick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services, and we have been working with Senator Jungbauer on getting this implemented. We believe this is the best way to be able to identify the differences between vehicles that are used for commercial purposes that, according to federal motor carrier safety regulations, need to have a USDOT number and need to be identified as such, and people that are using pickup trucks, but they're using them for non-commercial purposes. And so we've worked and collaborated with State Patrol so that we believe that this puts into effect the goals of Senator Jungbauer and what he was trying to accomplish. There wouldn't be any tax changes based on the way that this law has been drafted.
Any questions on the part of the committee? Seeing none, Senator DeCryf.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 1058 be recommended to pass and sent to the Senate floor.
Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you for your time, Mr. Chair and members.
Good luck, Senator Jungbauer. Next up is Senator Saxhog with Senate File 520.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you said, I have Senate File 520 with me today. It's the second part of a turn back of Highway 332 between the Department of Transportation in Cochinchin County. Cochinchin County is, well, International Falls is the county seat of Cochinchin County, to give you some idea where that is. Both parties are in agreement of this legislation, and with me today is Eric Radin from MnDOT to briefly describe the bill and help answer any questions.
Mr. Radin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Eric Radin with MnDOT Government Affairs, and for members who might be new to the Transportation Committee, all trunk highways are listed in state statute, and so pretty much every year we have what we call turnback legislation to amend statute for the turning back of the jurisdiction of former trunk highways to a city or a county. And so that's what this bill does. It, as Senator Saxhog indicated, is part of a process that began last year. A portion of this trunk highway went to the city of International Falls, and the bill before you this year is for the portion that's going to Cochinchin County. The funding is provided in the biennial appropriations bill for turnbacks. There's not specific funding for this turnback, which is typical. We just handle it through the budget bill. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Perry?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what would that be? What would be the cost?
Mr. Chair and Senator Perry, the amount for this portion is $4.5 million.
Senator Hall?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Radin, that $4.5 million, and that's not, that's for the future maintenance or of the road. However, it's not dedicated to that. The local entity can use it however they want. Is that correct, or is it in a special fund just for that roadway?
Mr. Chair and Senator Howe, it's specific to this roadway, which is the case with all of our turnbacks. We sign a memorandum of understanding with the city or the county specifying what the funds have to be used for. In some cases, MnDOT will perform the work before turning it back to the local unit of government because we always want to make sure that the roadway is in good condition when we give it to that local unit of government. In other cases, we give the local unit of government a lump sum of money, and then they will perform the work themselves. In some cases, the road might be in pretty good shape today, but maybe it needs to be repaved in 5 years' time, and so we give them the money today, and they hold on to it until such time as it's needed for that specific section of roadway. But in every case, we do put in the MOU that the money has to be used for that section of roadway.
Mr. Radin, is there enough money in that fund at the current time, or would this come under the new budget cycle that starts July 1st?
Mr. Chair, there's actually enough money that exists today, and each area transportation partnership receives a certain allotment for turnbacks, and MnDOT District 1, which is where this is, hasn't had a turnback in quite some time, so they have sort of a lot of money in the bank, if you will, for turnback projects. And so that's what this $4.5 million would be coming out of their portion of previous appropriations for turnbacks.
I think we probably better get this bill passed and out of here before that money disappears.
Mr. Chair,
to
that point, I guess I have a question about using that money right now, if now is a great time to do that. I mean, we have a $5 billion deficit right now we're trying to close, and I'm wondering if this could be held off for a couple of years in order to, I guess I'm just looking for a little advice on that.
My previous comment was more tongue-in-cheek than anything else, but this is dedicated funding from the Trunk Highway Fund that can't be used for general fund purposes, the way I understand it. We wouldn't be able to use that to reduce the deficit.
Yeah, could it be used for, Mr. Chair, could it be used for road maintenance? And
Mr. Chair, Senator DeKreif, this money can only be used, according to the state constitution, for turnbacks. It's part of what we call the 5% flex fund, which is a portion of the highway user tax distribution fund, that according to the Constitution, the legislature can determine how those funds are used every 6 years. and that was last changed, I think, in 2008. So until 2014, these funds have to be used for turnback purposes.
Mr. Chair. Could,
Senator DeCraft.
If I could, how much money is in this fund right now?
Mr. Rudin.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I would have to check on the balance. I think the appropriations bill, if Ms. Boyd could maybe help me out, has a few million dollars appropriated for turnbacks, but I would have to, again, check and get back to you. I'm sorry I don't have that.
Me either. Mr. Chair, if I could.
Senator DeCraft.
If there's $4.5 million here, what does a few million mean? Do you have an idea?
Mr. Rudin.
Mr. Chair and Senator DeCraft, as I mentioned earlier, each area transportation partnership around the state, which roughly mirrors the MnDOT district boundaries, gets an allotment. And this is all something we work out with the League of Minnesota Cities and the Association of Counties. And so in partnership with our ATPs and those groups, we try to come up with sort of a long-term plan for doing turnbacks, because there are certain instances where it makes more sense to have a road under local jurisdiction instead of state jurisdiction. And so the money that's in the biennial appropriations bill is not targeted to specific projects. Rather, it's distributed among the ATPs, and they get to decide how to use the money. But because there's only a few million dollars per biennium, what happens is the ATPs sort of take turns doing turnback projects. And so in this year, it's kind of District 1's turn for a turnback project. Last session, I think we had a turnback in the Metro District. Next year, we'll probably be here with legislation for a turnback in some other district. But so the money that's in the appropriations bill is not directly tied to specific projects generally. That's worked out in a separate process.
Well, thank you for that history of it. It's very helpful to understand how this process works, and that it's not certainly tied to the general fund or to our overall appropriation from the trunk highway. From the trunk highway fund or anything like that, and that it is really a local issue as far as who determines what the next turnback will be, and that whole process. It's pretty common in the 4 years I served on the transportation committee before. Virtually every year we had turnbacks of some type or another, and it's handy to be able to have that fund of money to bring that roadway up to good quality that will last for 20 years before we turn that stretch of roadway back over to the local units of government and avoid any costs that might be transferred to them in the process. So, any other questions? Senator Dibble?
Thanks. So to be clear, I mean, we presume this money does go to improve and benefit that specific project. That's still kind of hanging out there, that question. So I assume that's the case. And Mr. Chair, I'm ready to make a motion.
I got a question before that.
Senator Hall?
Well, you know, I Mr. Chair and Mr. Rudin, I understand under the memorandum of understanding that that's what the money is being paid to the local government for. But I guess my question is that if you were paying them $4.5 million and they have another road project over here, they can't use these funds today to do that road project. They go into a lockbox is what my understanding. Because I guess my understanding was is that even though you're paying the local government and they're assuming the liability for that roadway in the future, there could be a time where even though they've gotten money from the state, that there's road work that needs to be done, and they go back and just say, well, we need to raise some funds for here, so we're going to assess local property owners along this route. And it doesn't prohibit the local unit of government of making assessments, even though they've received money from the state for the maintenance of this road. So I guess I'm just looking for a little clarification on that, because what you just told me is different than what I've been experienced in the past.
Mr. Rudin.
Mr. Chair and Senator Howe, each turnback agreement is a little bit different because it has to be negotiated with the city or the county board.
Okay.
But it is certainly our intent, and I think it's the intent also of the County Engineers Association and the City Engineers Association, that the money a city or county receives for a turnback is used for that section of highway. Typically, and again, this varies case to case, but in this case, the agreement with the county, and I've got a copy here, the county cannot make any further claim for turnback funds for this portion of roadway in perpetuity. There's a complicated formula for determining how much money cities and counties get for state aid roads and highways. And this particular agreement says that the county can reinstate this portion of roadway for resurfacing needs only, but not for other needs that the roadway might have. So if there are other needs above resurfacing, then in that case they might assess adjoining property owners for, whether it's lighting or whatever some other of the needs might be.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Burke.
Thank you. I'm not quite sure. I still don't believe that I heard an answer to Senator DeKreif's question. As I understand, these monies every year, is it true that MnDOT projects the amount of dollars it's going to need for all the turnbacks and then puts that money into a pot and holds that until the turnbacks actually happen? Is that how this works?
Mr. Rudin?
Mr. Chair and Senator Perry, actually it's set by formula.
Okay.
In statute. I think it's approximately 40%. Perhaps Ms. Boyd could help me out.
Ms. Boyd?
Mr. Chair and Senators, the statutory 5% comes off the top of the highway user distribution fund before the amounts are distributed to trunk highway, county state aid, and municipal state aid. Of that 5%, it's broken down that 30% goes to town roads, 16.5% to town bridges. The remaining 53.5% is in the flex account, which is distributed by the commissioner, but is generally used only for turnbacks and some other small uses. But generally, the money is only used for turnbacks. Now, the breakdown of that amount is set by the commissioner and what between the counties and municipalities and staying with the trunk highways to get them in shape for the turnback.
Senator Perry?
Mr. Chair, and I think to Senator DeKreif's question, I believe when we saw the overviews was that there was a total listed. If I recall, when we were doing overviews, it showed the split and then had the total dollars available for the turnbacks. Am I correct on that, Mr. Chair?
You are correct on that, yes. There's okay. A hard number every biennial budget that's put into it.
Okay. And then one follow-up, Mr. Chair. Is there a time period when there is a requirement for turnback dollars to be given? And then to piggyback on that, I guess there was two. Is there that time period? And then would you explain further? You caught my attention when you said if turnback dollars were given, that local unit of government could use those dollars, and the only thing that they could come back to request from the state is overlay dollars? Did I hear that right?
Mr. Rudy?
Mr. Chair and Senator Perry, that's correct in this particular case, the agreement that we have with the county board. That's correct. Each turnback agreement is a little bit different depending on the needs of the roadway and, the negotiation with the county board or the city council. But in this agreement, it's I'll just read right here, the county may reinstate these segments for resurfacing needs only. So in other words, when the county is determining how much money they will get from county state aid highway funds, the only portion of needs that they can count for this segment of roadway is for resurfacing.
Senator Perry?
Well, Mr. Chair, now I'm a little a little concerned. Why would we give back turn back dollars to a road? I mean, we're giving the road back, so they're getting the dollars to use to bring this up to snuff if we're not going to do it the state. Why would we openly allow them then to turn right around and ask for more money on a road that we've turned back and paid the $4.2 million on? Why would we allow them to come back and ask us for another $1.2 down the road to resurface it? I mean, the idea of turning it back is to putting it back into the hands of the local unit of government, and it's their responsibility. So I'm somewhat concerned about that. Maybe this has been going on forever and ever. I'm not sure, but if it has, why don't we just keep the road if we're going to do that? It's concerning that we would give money and then give more on top of it a year or two down the road.
You ferreted out a very interesting point, Senator Perry, and I guess I too would like an answer to that, Mr. Rudin.
Mr. Chair, first of all, it's two separate pots of money, so the resurfacing in the future will no longer be a trunk highway expense. It will be a county-stated highway expense. So that's one reason why we do turnbacks. Secondly, all county state aid highways are typically eligible for using county state aid highways funds for resurfacing. There are standards that the county engineers come up with to determine how to spend county state aid highway funds, and they have all sorts of standards from pavement quality to the width of the shoulders to the slope of the ditches, and a county yearly goes out and assesses their needs for bringing their system up to state aid standards, and cities do the same thing. And then we look at the pot of money available in those two funds, and the money is allocated on formulas to help cities and counties bring their system up to state aid standards.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Perry.
It's still, a question still needs to, one that I'm sure needs to be somewhat vetted. Why would we bring a project whole, pay for it out of one fund, and then turn right around and take from another fund to do some resurfacing? I don't care if it's state aid or it doesn't make sense. If we're going to turn it over, then let's turn it over, give them the money, and be done with it. I mean, it's like we're paying for it twice.
Mr. Rudin, maybe you could tell us how often or how that we see this type of a provision in one of these turnbacks. I guess I wasn't aware that this was happening either. And is it quite common in this process?
Mr. Chair, as I said, each turnback agreement varies. This one is probably a little more detailed than some of the others that I've seen, but it just depends on a case-by-case basis. I will tell you that even if you resurface a road today, it's going to deteriorate and need resurfacing eventually. I mean, we resurfaced I-94 between the downtowns. I forget if it was the end of last summer or the summer before, but it's already showing signs of wear, and roads just need to be resurfaced periodically.
Senator Hall, first.
Mr. Chair, I two questions. One is, right now on a state highway, when you go past someone's farm and you're going to resurface it, do you do any assessments to that farm? Does the MnDOT assess that farmer for, his frontage on that road?
Mr. Rudy?
Mr. Chair and Senator Howe, I'm not aware of any instance where we've done that on a trunk highway.
Mr. Chair, and I think maybe the question behind the question over here with Senator Perry is, I think when you say every MOU is different, I think that's, when we're making these decisions whether or not to turn back, because I'm all in favor of turning things back, and we need to have a better understanding. We need to be able to see what those terms are, because we may, for instance, pay a county to take this road back, and then the county can turn around and say, well, you know, to get this done, we're going to assess the property owners along this route. Now that, to me, we're going to tax the people that have, as a local unit of government, we're going to tax the people that have frontage on this road, whereas if it was a state route, it wouldn't have been, they wouldn't have had that assessment. So, you know, those are things that I think we need to take in concern. As far as the resurfacing money, once it gets turned back over, it becomes part of the county system and part of the county aid state funding. They can apply for resurfacing dollars because it's no different than any other roadway. But my concern lies in the fact that we can turn around and do assessments on that roadway then. And I would look at it as if we're going to pay a local unit of government to take this back, then I'd certainly want to prohibit that they can just raise taxes on the property owners along there. That's my concern. I as far as once it becomes back part of the local system, they can apply for funding however they want to do it. But I do think we need to see those memorandum of understanding so we can make a informed decision. If everyone is different, I don't know how we can just go ahead and say, well, let's turn this one back when we don't know the details and how the taxpayers' interest and the state's interests are protected in those. And I know that may be, you know, like you just said, that there's a lot of details in this one. There should be a lot of details in them, but I think for us to make an informed decision, we'd need to know what those details are.
Senator Dibble?
Thanks, Mr. I was just going to make a similar point to Senator Howell's about what we do when we turn a roadway back. It back in good shape and good repair, and then it just becomes part of the system, and then it's treated like the part of the county stated highway system. So the subsequent resurfacing is just like normal. I do believe that we need to turn those roads back, you know, in good repair with the resources so that the county can bring it up to their standards. And then subsequent, you know, I just don't see it as double dipping. Then it becomes a part of the system. So if there's frontage assessment, you know, so be it. So I have a slightly different perspective there. I also don't necessarily want to see all these MOUs because I barely keep up with what I have to read as it is.
Certainly we can understand Senator Howe's concern for the local taxpayer in this process. And you know, maybe we do need to take a look.
Mr. Chair, I have actually a copy here. If Mr. Rudy, you'd like, I can give it to the page. And
not probably of this particular memorandum of understanding, but at the process, and
yes.
You know, at some point in time, that might be a good thing to do. But Senator Saxog is bringing this forward, and so he's the one that probably will have to answer should the property taxes go up on that particular piece of roadway because of the result of this. But I'm sure he's quite protective of his property taxpayers. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? I have yeah. Senator DeCray.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Radin, I'm trying to understand this here some. It sounds like, a little bit to me, like if you run into a particularly good negotiator, they're going to make out better from the state, rather than us have a standardized system of what level we agree automatically to bring a road back to before we turn it back. Is that fairly accurate?
Mr. Chair and Senator DeKreif, I don't think so, because I think there's a lot of self-policing amongst the county engineers and the city engineers. And, you know, we do turnbacks frequently enough that they don't want to see unfair conditions for one turnback when, you know, they had a turnback 5 years ago and they didn't get those similar conditions. So I think they're fairly standard. You know, each case is just a little bit different. You know, and it depends somewhat on who's on the city council or who's on the county board and what their concerns might be or what the adjoining property owner's concerns might be as to what, you know, goes into the formal MOU. But as I said, I think there's enough attention paid by the county engineers and city engineers that there is a great deal of standardization in these agreements.
So, Mr. Rudin, does this MOU go back to the ATB before it gets to this process where Senator Saxog would bring a bill?
Or Mr. Chair, I guess I'd have to check as to whether there's a review by the ATP. I think typically these are negotiated between the district state aid engineer and you know, the county engineer or city engineer, and how much external review it gets, I guess I'd have to check on that.
But typically the city or the county engineer is involved in this ATP process anyhow, and has input into that and receives input from the other members of the ATP in this turnback process and how those dollars are going to get used. So there is a level of understanding on the local level of what the costs are going to be to turn back this piece of roadway, and you know, so it's not a totally unmanaged type of an approach. There are some checks and balances in there on the local level and by the local partners of the ATPs. Is that
correct? Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think that's an accurate statement, yes.
Any other questions? Seeing none, Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 520 be recommended to pass. Be referred to the floor.
Senator Dibble recommends that Senate File 520 be recommended to pass and sent to the Senate floor. Any further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you, Senator Saxog. Next up is Senator Sparks with Senate File 1083.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to present Senate File 1083. And I do believe if council would be able to help me, I do have an author's amendment that is just agreed upon language that was added in the House. I think it's the A1 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the A1.
Senator Perry moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. To the amendment, Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And this was a bill that was brought forward to me by the Minnesota Professional Towing Association. It simply clarifies the definition of a public impound lot. With that, I have two witnesses here with me today. I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Rob Layton to give you some more details as to why this legislation is necessary.
Mr. Layton.
Hi, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. I'll be very brief.
If you could identify yourself.
I'm Rob Layton. I'm with the law firm of Nolan Thompson Layton in St. Paul, and I work on behalf of the Professional Towing Association. And I have Art Smith with me of Automedics, and Blaine, who, if the committee has any questions, can provide further information. As some of you who have served on the Transportation Committee may know, sometimes when towing issues come forward, some have been somewhat controversial in the past. This is not one of those issues, Mr. Chairman and members. The groups that sometimes have an interest in towing issues are the City of Minneapolis, City of St. Paul, League of Minnesota Cities, and sometimes Legal Aid. And so when we came forward with this legislation, we met with all of those groups to get their feedback. None of those groups have any opposition or concern with this bill at all. There's no known opposition to this bill. In fact, the author's delete all amendment is actually language that the City of Minneapolis thought would address one of their longer-term concerns that really doesn't have to do with our clarification, but something that could be an issue to them down the road. So there's no known opposition to this bill. The issue, Mr. Chairman and members, is that currently if you're a private business person that owns an impound lot, if you're asked by a city or a unit of government to haul in a car to the impound lot, the current language would then say that your private impound lot becomes a public impound lot simply by acting in that manner. We believe that this amendment, the author's amendment, will clarify that, in fact, it still remains a non-public or private impound lot, so that the only public impound lots are either the public impound lot in the City of Minneapolis or the City of St. Paul, or if in the future they decide that they would like to lease out property that could be a private impound lot if it were to be operated solely for the benefit of that public entity, that would remain public. But for all other purposes, the private impound lots would remain private. That's what we're simply trying to get at. This fix was actually, I believe, in the omnibus transportation bill a couple of years ago. That bill was vetoed by Governor Pawlenty. That's why we're back this year trying to simply clarify this in a way that all the parties are satisfied with. With that, I'll turn it over to Art Smith of Auto Medics to provide any more information.
Mr. Chair, committee members, it just would make it a lot easier for the public to understand it. They don't understand the different rules of what a private versus public impound lot is. They call all the time asking. It'll save a lot of hassle so they can just go to the law, look it up, and they'll understand everything a lot better. Thank you.
Senator Dibble?
Thanks. Chair, Senator Sparks, or Mr. Layton, what are the different rules? What is the confusion, source of the confusion?
Well, municipality-owned can get rid of the cars in 15 days. We hold ours 45 days. It's basically the length of time you have to hold a car. We've been holding them for the 45 days, unless their piece is missing or whatever, then it goes under the 30 or 15-day law. But if it's municipality-owned, they can get rid of their vehicles in 15 days.
And Mr. Smith, just by getting the term getting rid of, what is that?
To sell them, junk them, whatever. Dispose of them.
And that is 15 days after the date you tow it and put it on the lot?
Yes. That's not us, though. That's what we're trying to verify here, separate us from public versus municipality.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Layton,
on that issue, if it's, and Senator Dibble, if it's a private lot, a non-public lot, they have to hold it for a longer period than if it was a public impound lot, which is why Legal Aid actually supports the bill. They would like it to have to be held for that longer period.
So, any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Berzofsky?
Mr. Chair, I believe another difference has to do with the sale proceeds, that a public impound lot essentially pays itself back for its costs, and then the remainder goes back to the vehicle owner. The remainder goes back to the government, and then in a private impound lot, the lot operator keeps the entire proceeds of the sale.
Go ahead, Senator Lohr.
Mr. Chair, I've got a question on the A1. Just the syntax, exclusively contracted solely, seems kind of a little redundant, like we really, really mean it. Are those two words both needed? I mean,
Mr. Chairman, that language, we, in dealing with representatives from the city of Minneapolis, that language was, I guess, agreed to. We wanted to make it, I guess, crystal clear that it wouldn't become public simply because it was a private lot that did something on behalf of the municipality. And that was language that I guess was agreed to by the staff in the House. So the amendment you see in front of you is the exact language that's in the House bill. And I think we'd like to just keep it at that point, but your point's well taken.
Okay. Senator Dibble?
It just reminds me of the time we established the Department of Redundancy Department. My questions have been answered.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair,
Senator DeCraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I just have a question, and I don't want to get into the weeds too far in this, but if somebody went on a two-week vacation and they happen to have their car towed, is this basically saying that they could come back 2 weeks later and the car not only wouldn't be there, but it wouldn't be in the impound lot anymore because it would have been sold or junked?
Well,
Mr. Smith,
are you talking about the city one or private? Private, we hold them 45 days. A city, if they're going to do them through the auctions and that, they're longer than 15 days. Usually it takes them a while to get it run through the auction. They have certain paperwork they have to do. We're all required to send out certified letters and everything, notifying them. As far as the city goes, I could not answer if it's 15 days, 21 days, or anything. I couldn't answer that because we don't go by those rules.
Senator Dibble?
But, Mr. Chair, if it is in a city lot, it's possible. Be gone.
If it is.
Yeah.
Getting quite an education in the Transportation Committee today. Yeah, I guess I didn't realize that either. But it is what it is. I'm sure those rules have been around for a long period of time, and it's the first I've heard of it. So, any other questions?
But
Senator Lori?
Mr. Chair, I think on that point, though, the bill here would actually make it clear that for a larger class of towing, that a longer time would apply. So it would actually go partway to address some of those concerns.
Okay. I think you're right, Senator. Senator Dibble?
Right.
We are.
He's not.
So, Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 1083, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the floor.
That's where it's headed. So, Senator Dibble moves that Senate File 1083, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the Senate floor. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Next up is Senator Cruz, Senate File 1078. Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. If it would be all right with you, Mr. Chairman, I do have a delete all amendment. If I could move the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape I'd like it.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves the A2 amendment, and you're having it passed out at this time. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. Today before you have Senate File 1078. This is a bill that the Department of Transportation approached me with, and I thought it was kind of a neat idea. The whole purpose of this is to explore the idea of private financing for some of our trunk highway projects. Essentially, what this bill would do is it would authorize the department to do one project, just one pilot project. They don't have any in particular in mind just yet. They did want to get the legislation passed simply for the reason of these things come up rather quickly. And if somebody who is willing to be a private source of financing would come forward, they wanted to be able to move on that. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Scott Peterson and let him tell you a little bit more about it.
Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Scott Peterson from MnDOT, and I'd like to thank Senator Cruz for carrying this bit of legislation for us. This is basically half of a bill that Senator Jungbauer carried for us last year, and as Senator Cruz described, it really is just an opportunity for us to explore whether there might be some occasions out there where private financing could help us bring more resources into the financing of transportation improvement projects. And as Senator Cruz also correctly pointed out, there are occasions where we have projects that occur out there that could benefit from a transportation investment, but they're not currently in the program, and the programming process isn't really timely enough for us to address the need. And there may be a party that would benefit from the project that has the resources and the willingness to invest in the project, and we would just like the authority to enter into a conversation with those folks and use that as a way to perhaps accelerate this project. Some of the language in the amendment that you have before you is our attempt to address some of the concerns we've heard from members about whether this financing authority would disadvantage some projects that have been patiently waiting their turn in the program and moving through the programming process. And it is certainly not our intent, nor would we actually entertain a possibility that would do that, that would delay a project that's currently in the program. And as Senator Cruz also said, we don't have a project in mind, but we occasionally do get inquiries from interested parties wondering if we would be interested in entering into an agreement like this, but our conversation usually doesn't progress very far because of our uncertainty about whether we would actually have the authority to do that. And the conversion of our legislation to a pilot program is really in response to some of the concerns I heard last year about how using an approach like this would fit within the existing state systems and work, again, within our regular financing approach for projects. And so essentially that is the bill, and I would certainly entertain any questions members might have.
Senator Rust.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Peterson, even though you said that the conversations have not gone very far, what types of projects have you been approached about?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, my understanding is that these have usually been in conjunction with an improved access, maybe a left turn lane or an intersection control stoplight, for example, where someone might be wanting to develop an adjacent land parcel that would generate some significant traffic volume, and they just want to make sure that there's safe access to the project. And again, because there's no money currently available in a district's construction program, we are not able to finance those entirely under our traditional approach.
Mr. Chairman, and, Mr. Peterson, and how many people have approached you? I mean, you know, has it been dozens or just a few, or what? How frequently does that happen?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, I think it's more on the order of a handful over the last couple years, not dozens.
Senator Cruz?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Rest, just to kind of add on to what Mr. Peterson has said here, I almost wonder if some of the reason that these folks wouldn't come forward is because of the way that it's the system is structured now and how difficult it is to potentially move one of these projects through. I think that's one of the reasons why the department would like this, is to kind of streamline that so that if somebody were to approach them, maybe it would be a little bit more inviting to get through that. And I also think that, you know, I like, you know, what Mr. Peterson said here too. The thing that excited me the most about this is the potential for economic development. If you have somebody who's willing to develop a certain area and they understand that they will profit from that, but there's a project out here that needs to get done first, if they would be willing to front that money in order to continue with that development, I think especially in this economic climate, that would be an advantageous thing for us to do.
Senator Rust.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Peterson, and thank you, Senator Cruz. On lines 122, 123, it says this subdivision does not preempt any other statute or provide any new toll facility authority or design build contracting authority. Does that mean that pilots that are undertaken could not include dynamic pricing and congestion pricing on any new roads if that was... seem to be a benefit by the private entity?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, I don't anticipate that we would attempt to use this provision for that purpose. I think if one of those types of projects came forward, I think we would come back to the legislature and have a conversation about it.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm actually still trying to understand what this is, what's being contemplated. Mr. Peterson, you can provide us maybe just a more specific, concrete example. I know that a few years ago, a corporate campus wanted to improve an interchange nearby, and so they were able to look over at least a portion of the dollars for that, for the capital needs. To build, to finish out, not the whole, and MnDOT can have sufficient properties to accept those dollars. How is this different than that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, my understanding is that those types of arrangements in the past have gone through local governments, and so like the private entity has had an agreement with the local government, and then MnDOT entered into an agreement with the local government. That's, for example, the type of agreement we have down at the Elk Run interchange associated with the proposed bioscience development on Highway 52. And so that what I would point to as maybe a better example of how we might use this is we have current statutory authority to allow us to enter into agreements with local governments where they can fund transportation improvements like interchanges, for example, where it's been used in the past, and then we agree to repay the local government at some point in the future when that project was in our plans or in our program to build that project. So it just moves it forward in time, and that authority allows us to either not pay interest to the local government or actually pay interest to them for that financing.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, and that surfaces my other question, which was, and I see that the this is just a pilot. I appreciate that. And I see you need the approval of the Commissioner of Management and Budget. But my question is about exposing Trunk Highway Fund to additional debt financing costs and the like. How has MnDOT thought about that issue in particular, particularly if this gets beyond the pilot phase? You know, I know that past legislatures and now MnDOT itself is very concerned about making sure we manage the debt to available funds ratio.
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, we would consider any loan or financing that we would obtain through an agreement of this nature to be subject to the limits that we've established in our debt management policy, which is we've established as a ceiling of 20% of our forecasted state revenues as our maximum debt service payment we would be willing to commit in any year.
Senator Dibble, on line 1.24 and 2.5, they pretty much expressed that they are, these policies must live within that debt
area. Should read the bottom of it.
Gets a little long on the bill, but okay. Any other questions? Seeing none, Senator Howe moves that Senate file. Pardon me? Senator Cruz can use his own bill. Senator Cruz, do you have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move that Senate File 1078 be recommended to pass as amended and be sent to the Senate floor.
Senator Cruz has moved Senate File 1078 be recommended as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the Senate floor. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
I don't care, that one's fine.
We'll now hear Senate File 1147, Senator Gimsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 1147 is also a department initiative that we would like to move on. It's been in the discussion phase for most of this session, and the details have been worked out pretty well. It What this bill does is creates a mechanism by which the department would have the authority to enter into agreements for construction management and general contractors. And with us is Mr. Hippus with MnDOT to explain the bill.
Mr. Hippus.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jay Hippus. I'm MnDOT's Innovative Contracting Director. I'd like to thank Senator Gimsey for helping us sponsor this bill. I'm going to go over an overview of the bill and how construction manager general contractor works. Currently, MnDOT has two project delivery methods. Our traditional method is design bid build. In that method, MnDOT designs the project to 100%, and then we let it out to bid for the lowest contractor. With this method, there's very little contractor involvement. The design is often not optimized, and there's a potential for a lot of innovation in terms of cost savings with it. Our second procurement tool is design build. Design build has been very successful recently on several high-profile projects, such as the Hastings River Bridge on Highway 61, the 169-494 interchange, and the 610 expansion project through Maple Grove on it. Design build is a good project delivery tool also. Here, the designer is working directly for the contractor on it. So you've seen a lot of innovation and a tremendous amount of cost savings in some of these major projects with it. But design build is not great for every single project. There is risk transfer that goes along with it to the contractor. At the same time, there's a loss of control on the design to some degree on MnDOT's part. What CMGC does, it kind of combines the best of both worlds on it. MnDOT still retains the design. We still have final ownership of the design and the final decision-making process on the design. But we gain the innovation and the cost savings of having the contractor work directly with MnDOT's designer on it. So the process is basically broken up into two phases. Early in the project development process, MnDOT would hire a construction manager, general contractor, to come and work with us and our designers on it. There's a lot of benefits during this. The contractors can help us manage our risk on our side through our costs. They're going to help us optimize the design for their means and methods on it. They're going to help us through some permitting issues. They can help us through environmental issues. And they can look at projects much differently than MnDOT looks at things when we're designing it. So by gaining the innovation of having the contractor in the room with us, there's a potential for a significant amount of cost savings in the construction side of the project. As the design gets to be completed, we enter into phase two with the construction manager general contractor. During this phase of the project, we'll actually negotiate a contract with the contractor to construct it. We've added some safeguards inside the legislation to ensure that the taxpayers are getting a good price for this. If for some reason we are unable to negotiate a price with the contractor, and that would be our goal on every job is to negotiate a fair price, but for some reason we're not able to negotiate a price, MnDOT reserve the right to take the ideas that the contractor has given us during the design and let that project out to the lowest bidder that goes along with it. This has been used successfully in other states. Utah DOT has done this significantly over the past couple years. So we've been talking with the Utah DOT and the Oregon DOT and other professionals around the country on CMGC contracting. Utah DOT has noticed a 6-9% cost savings using CMGC. Oregon DOT had reduced the risk on a significant bridge project using CMGC. We will be introducing an amendment to modify the bill slightly. We've been working with AGC on some of the language. We'd like to change the bill instead of two projects per year into a pilot program. We'll be coming up with a number of projects, but limiting it to a pilot program so we can kind of test run how this works before we go to any full-scale implementation on it, and then working with AGC on a couple other minor small changes to the bill.
Questions? Mr. Chairman, I understand that there is a small fiscal cost to this. Maybe the department can talk a little bit about that, or Ms. Boyd.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gimsey, I believe the fiscal note is still has not been signed off on by MMB. My understanding is that there will be some small startup costs to this proposal, and MnDOT is planning to include those in their current operating budget. And weren't quantified in the fiscal note. Also, they, in the narrative, talk about some savings to the construction program that should be, in the narrative, greater than the cost to the program. But again, these are not quantified in the fiscal note at this time.
Thank you. Members, any questions? Senator Gimsey, would you...
Did Senator Gimsey say that there was going to be an amendment to the bill?
Senator Gimsey?
Well, Senator Rest, I don't have an amendment for this bill.
Oh, I thought the gentleman said that they needed a technical amendment or something.
Senator Gimsey?
Okay, Mr. Hippis has reaffirmed what he had said earlier, that the amendment will be to turn this into a pilot program so that it can be studied, of course, before it proceeds. But that amendment will be available for the floor.
Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Gemsy. Senator Gemsy, I'm sorry.
The amendment is still being worked on. The details of the language are still being worked on with ACG.
Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chairman, if I could follow up.
All right, Senator Rust.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Gemsy, it's a little bit unusual to change something that big. So I would feel better about it if you could speak to the details of how this is going to be a pilot project. Maybe not the language of an amendment, but just spell out the details of how this can be turned into a pilot project and what might be changed, or the areas that you might be changing your bill through an amendment.
Mr. Hippis?
If you don't mind, Senator Gemsy.
Senator Gemsy, do you have a response?
Mr. Hippis is going through the bill right now to look for the section that would be changed to change it into a pilot project, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Hippis.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I can't find the exact language, but there is a line in here that says that it can only be used on up to two projects per year. We would strike that line, and at the end of the bill, we would say that this will be used on up to 10 projects, and it would sunset at the end of those 10 projects, or another number that we're still working with, AGC. So it would be a finite number of projects instead of two projects per year. So that line would be stricken from the bill.
And, Mr. Chairman, and sir, then if typically it would have been two projects a year, then if that same number crops up, then we're looking at approximately a five-year pilot project. Would that be your best estimate?
Mr. Hippis?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, we have yet to determine the number of projects working with AGC on it. We would like to test it on a number of projects to make sure that it's, instead of just looking at one case study, looking at several case studies, we still need to work on that. So it could be anywhere from a 2 to 10 year program, depends on the number of projects and the pace at which these projects are rolled out. We'd be looking for optimizing which projects they work on. We wouldn't want to have any language that would say they have to be done by a certain date. We'd like to make sure that we're using it on the right project at the right time versus trying to force it into a finite timeline.
Mr. Chairman, that was going to be my next question. Why the number of projects was preferable to having a 5-year, 6-year timeline? That makes a lot of sense.
That answer your question, Senator Rice?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just before you move forward, I was hoping you'd just ask if perhaps anyone wants to testify on the bill. I don't know if anyone does, but
sure,
AGC,
absolutely,
if they wanted to.
We'll do that, Senator Sieben. Senator Dribble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I requested amendment, oral amendment. And that's on line 4.25. It says the commissioner shall notify the chairs of the Senate and House of Representatives, blah, blah, blah. And we also ask that the ranking minority members receive the same consideration. So I would insert shall notify the chairs and ranking minority members of the Senate, et cetera.
Senator Dempsey to that.
I think that is more than appropriate, and I think it's a good amendment to incorporate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Gemsy, I'll make that motion.
All right. Senator Dibble makes an oral amendment. Senator Council, you want to?
On line 4.25, after chairs, insert and ranking minority members.
To that motion, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, nay. Amendment passes. Senator Dibble.
A question, and it's kind of along the lines of reporting. I was wondering how are we going to A, measure whether or not this pilot is successful, and B, what are plans to report on the results of the pilot to the legislature?
Mr. Hippis.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we anticipate if this procurement method is used, if there's any federal funds, and most of our products have federal funds on, the federal government will require special reporting requirements that we would have to do for the federal government. We'd also be making those would be also public documents. For the reporting on it, we were planning on, at the end of the 10 projects, coming back to the legislature and determining if that was something that Mindet would want to pursue further to, you know, eliminate the pilot program on it, that we'd have to document and justify why we'd want to get rid of the pilot and just go forward with a certain number of products per year. So our goal was to, at the end of the 10 projects, come back and give an update on where we were going to head in the future with CMGC.
Senator Glewell.
So just what should we, in the meantime, be keeping an eye out for in terms of measures of success?
Mr. Hippis.
Savings in time or savings in money or innovative designs? What are some of the things that we should just kind of be keeping our ear to the ground?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would say time and money are the biggest things. Money, primarily, we anticipate we'll save a significant amount of money during construction. And also time, if we get the contractors in there to help us expedite these projects. They maybe have an innovative way that we can build it faster, or they can procure materials early compared to waiting until, if you have a major project, the contractor can't really procure any items until that contract is signed. A lot of times there's a lot of lead time. For example, steel beams and signal system poles require a significant amount of lead time. With this method, the contractor can actually be procuring those items early to help that construction timeline along. But those would be the two measurable things, are time and money, more significantly on the money side.
Thank you.
Senator Lilly. Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the line that you were looking for was line 413. Perhaps you had found that. And again, my question was relating to so really there's no need for a sunset on this because you will complete 10 projects, that is the plan, and after that time you will come back to the legislature and have another conversation about whether to go forward, or is that the general consensus?
Mr. Hippis.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes. We're not sure if it's actually 10 projects. We're still working on the number with AGC on it, but we want to say up somewhere in the 2 to 10 project range. We haven't decided on a number yet with them, but that is the ultimate goal, yes. And the reason is that just setting up the number of projects versus a timeline. When you have a timeline, we don't want to be picking projects that may not work just to test out the model. We want to make sure the model is used on the right job at the right time.
Members, any other questions for MnDOT? All right, anyone?
Yes, Senator.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I didn't hear the first part of your presentation, so you may have answered this, but would this pilot be applied to a project that's already in a it's already been selected by the existing criteria, or would the capacity of a project to be financed with some public dollars cause it to go ahead of other projects that cannot find partners like that for the project?
Mr. Hippis.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we'd be looking at, you know, typical MnDOT projects and using this model on, whether those projects are in the program now or if they're future projects. The model is not to be used to have projects jump over one another to gain rank and get funding on. It's when a project is, you know, funded, what delivery tool are we going to use to best manage the delivery of that, whether it's design build, design bid build, or CMGC. So it's not a tool to have projects skip around in order. It's this job is now advanced. We need to start working on the design of that project for a certain date where it's programmed to be let for construction. So that's when it would be, the decision would be made based on the risk of the job and when to use it. You know, say some jobs might be better design build candidates for a risk transfer. Some jobs, maybe the traditional method is the best method. But, you know, this method would be if it's a highly complex project, we really want those contractor skills to help us out with some complex issues. But it would be our normal traditional program projects.
Senator Laurie.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I just have a comment about how you frame the amendment that will be coming our way, and I'm glad Senator Rust asked that question, because typically when we in the legislature hear that a proposal coming before us is going to be turned into a pilot project, that brings up a certain amount of criteria, like we think it's going to be slowed down and things like that, and maybe some questions were raised, and we think that the scope is different. And if we hadn't asked for that question from a scope that allowed two per year, a maximum of two per year, to that would take it a minimum of 5 years to get to a 10 project level, to a change that allows up to 10 projects in any time frame, it actually could significantly speed this up. So when you couch it as turning this into a pilot project, you know, you just need to be. I'm glad we got that explanation, because it maybe you should describe it as something other than turning it into a pilot project, because you could be significantly speeding this up, and I think that you know, you've made a good case for why the change. But legislators, I myself anyway, hear something very different when it's described as a pilot project than when we dug into what the changes actually will be. So more a comment than anything else.
All right. Anyone else would like to testify on Senate File 1147? Senator Sharon?
Sorry, I'm still I'm trying to make certain that I understand that, you know, in order for a project to even be a pilot project, the project would have to be one in which some private entity might have an interest in participating in the financing, and that interest might be related to where their corporate offices are, or some initiative like that.
Mr. Chair,
I'm seeing this occurring.
Senator Sharon, are you looking at Senate File 1147?
That's a different bill.
Oh, am I on the wrong bill? Never mind.
All right.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else that would like to test either for or against Senate File 1147? All right. With that, Senator Rest.
Thank you. They may not want to testify now, but Senator Ginsey, I think it would be helpful on the floor if you would have some sort of communication from AGC saying that they support those changes and everything. I think that would be very helpful.
Thank you, Senator Russ. That's a good idea, and we'll try to provide for that.
So guess who's coming forward?
maybe you've inspired them, Senator
Russ. Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Tom Murphy. I represent the Associated General Contractors. We've been in ongoing conversations with MnDOT, and I'm confident that we can reach an agreement relatively soon.
Thank you. That's helpful.
All right. Thank you. Senator Gimsey, what's your intentions with this bill?
Senator Howe, I'd like to lay this bill over until Thursday so that we can work out the language of the amendment, adopt that on Thursday, and then move it to the Senate floor.
All right. Without objection, Senator Gimsey moves to lay this over until Thursday. Any objections? All right. Senator Gimsey, Senate File 1215 to that bill.
Chair, members, Senate File 1215 is the culmination of an ongoing effort for a number of years, which would allow for the use of credit cards in our driver's license agencies. And with me is Ms. McCormick to explain the mechanics of that.
Ms. McCormick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick, Director of Driver and Vehicle Services. And in 2009, legislation was passed that authorized the department to promulgate rules so that we could have consistent practices with deputy registrars and driver's license agents in the acceptance of credit card convenience fees as part of motor vehicle and driver license transactions. At the time, there was a couple different versions of this language in various bills, and the one that passed strictly mentioned deputy registrars and not driver license agents. And as you know, those are two separate appointments within the department. The commissioner appoints deputy registrars to do motor vehicle transactions, and the commissioner appoints driver license agents to do driver's license transactions. Many deputy registrars also do all types of driver license transactions, but all deputy registrars are called limited driver license agents because they all can issue duplicate driver licenses, which means that you're coming in just to get your address changed on the card. There's no picture, there's no identification review, and those kinds of things. And so we worked with the association on the rules. We tried to include things that would be helpful. There are some large deputy registrars that have point-of-sale systems, and they wanted to be able to use those. We have been working with them, and also some smaller offices that may believe that because of financial hardship at this time, they didn't believe they wanted to process credit card transactions. And about 3 weeks ago, the Office of Administrative Hearings notified the department that we did not have authority to include driver license agents in our rulemaking because the statute didn't explicitly state driver license agents. We had used the argument that all deputy registrars are limited driver license agents. And so we really appreciate Senator Gimsey bringing this legislation forward. We thought we were almost ready to begin the implementation process, and now we will be. We and the deputy registrar administrative rules are moving forward, and so we are asking in this legislation to do expedited rulemaking so that we can have deputy registrars and driver license agents both be able to use credit card or allow credit card transactions to be processed and to charge the customer the convenience fee that's associated with it.
Members, question, Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. McCormick, just out of curiosity, do you know if a similar fee can be charged for fishing licenses or hunting licenses?
Ms. McCormick.
I know this has been an issue I've seen over and over again, and I don't really know where it's at right now, I guess. That's why I'm asking.
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sieben, the DNR also has transactions done by deputy registrar offices, and they we did tell them that was one of the reasons for the allowing the point of sale system as well. At first we thought we would only allow that, but we worked with management and budget, who oversees all oversees a contract with the state bank, who processes all of our state agency transactions and accounts for them. And they thought it would be fine if a deputy registrar wanted to also use that same system for DNR transactions. So
thank you.
Any other question, members? Senator Gimsey, your wishes on this?
Mr. Chairman and members, I would move that Senate File 1215 be recommended to pass and then re-referred to the State Government Innovation and Vets Committee.
Senator Gimsey moves that Senate File 1250 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the State Government Innovations and Veterans Commissions. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
Thank you very much.
Motion passes. Seeing no further business to come before this committee, the Transportation Committee stands in adjournment.